Hello and welcome to the PFA podcast. I'm John Didlitzer, Chief Executive of the PFA. I'm here joined today by Brett Taylor, our recently appointed Research and Innovation Executive. Welcome, Brett.
Hello, John. Good to be here.
Thank you. Pretty proud this week to have launched our PFA Player Pathway study. In some ways, it's 15 years in the making. It probably took us 6 to 12 months to actually work through all the information we had and build the report that we ultimately released during August. And what really inspired or certainly was the catalyst for doing this report was the amount of discussion youth development and player careers had, you know, in the coffee shops and the playing pitches and offices of Australia, and noting anecdotally there was a decline, and trying in some way to build a framework or some structure around discussing A, whether that was true, and B, where the starting point was to try and find some solutions to that. So, Brett, you were intimately involved in developing the document. Did you want to speak to some of the, I suppose, the scope of the document, but also some of the key findings that you thought were of interest?
Yeah, for sure. I think, just to echo what you said, I think there was already a lot of discussion out there in the Australian football community sort of around this youth development question, and is the same quality of player coming through? So it was fantastic to undertake a study of such breadth and depth to cover over 600 players, around 3.5 million professional league minutes played by those Australian players across 14 years from 2002 to 2016, to answer the question with hard data rather than just sort of anecdotal feel as to where we're at and how that's changing over time. And I think sort of the biggest key finding at a macro level is just the fact that the total professional minutes played by Australian players has been declining year on year since 2010. So that answers the question, I think, pretty comprehensively, that something is happening, things are sliding, and the next step, I guess, is to better understand that problem and then eventually start to move towards solutions. So, John, why do you think, just at a broad level, that downwards trend might be occurring?
Yeah, it's the billion-dollar question, given where transfer fees are at currently. And it's really difficult to pinpoint. I think people try to isolate different areas that might be contributing to a decline in the number of players that we have playing in the top leagues. And one of the key findings of the study was the huge decline in players in the top five leagues in Europe, and something like an 80% reduction over the past 10 years. And why that's important is because we think the metric of who's playing in the top five leagues really does measure who the best players are. They have the most money, they've got the most at stake, they play in the Champions League. So the market will tell us the players in those teams are the best players in the world. And we don't have enough, or we certainly have 80% less players being involved at that level than we had 10 years ago. So that would indicate, I think, pretty strongly that the caliber of players that we're producing isn't keeping pace with the rest of the world. So that doesn't mean our players aren't better than the guys 10 years ago. It just means our players aren't improving their performance at the same rate as other markets, as other countries around the world. And you know, why is that the case? I think it's really simplistic to try not isolate one or two or three different things. I think we need to step back. And now that we've got this data, it tells us there is an issue. We need to step back and find out what are the biggest influences on us not being able to keep pace with the rest of the world. So you might have a discussion about the curriculum. And is it one-dimensional? Is it restricting the development of players because the curriculum didn't exist before 2005? Maybe. I think it's difficult, though, to use that one factor as being, or point to that one factor as being entirely the problem. You just can't draw that from the data, and you can't draw that more generally. The second point might be the changes to the FIFA regulations. Before 2005, players under the age of 18 could try their luck in Europe. There wasn't that same preclusion. In recent years, FIFA has banned the transfers of minors, which means Australians can't go to those top five leagues before the age of 18. Now, has that been a factor as well? Maybe that's been an issue. Is it the fact our backyards are getting smaller? Is it the fact there's less time spent with the ball doing unstructured learning? I mean, there's so many of these factors, and we need to actually drill down and isolate different things to see exactly where we can find improvement. And we can do that by studying the way other countries are continuing to produce players. You know, it's why is France continuing to produce, or why are they now in the midst of this huge glut of high-quality young footballers coming through? You look at their team that beat the Netherlands 4-0. It's such an exciting young team. So what is France doing beyond having a larger population than Australia to make sure that the development of their players is outstripping the rest of the world? You know, what has Iceland done to make sure that they can concentrate a very small population and produce a high quality national team, but also high quality players? I mean, Gylfi Sigurdsson went for 40 million euros, I think, or 40 million pounds to Everton or thereabouts. So we're not even talking about Australians attracting that level of values. And should we be producing more accomplished players in Iceland? I'd argue yes, for any number of reasons. So that's how complex the whole discussion is, and I think to try and isolate it too early does the analysis a disservice. And I think we really need to do a deep dive on how we can build a framework to improve players relative to the rest of the world.
Yeah, so I think you've summed it up well, is that it's a complex answer. People want a simple answer. People want to just hear that coaching's no good, or we need more investment in pitches, or one thing or another. But given that there's so many different complex factors interplaying at the same time, how will the PFA help shape and lead that discussion over the next 6-12 months to eventually lead towards some actionable policies and solutions?
Was that a question? For me?
Well, sure.
I thought you'd have the answer. That's why you're the research and innovation executive. So we need to do we're partnering with the university to try and explore some of these answers, or support, to really address some of these questions and try and find the answers. Yeah, it's easy to try and come up with a very quick answer, but I think that, again, does the game a disservice. The reality is Australia has strong fundamentals to excel at football. You know, population's small, but it's not the number of elite athletes that we have within our population hasn't prevented us from being a world leader in a host of other sports around the world that are competed for aggressively. Sport has a halo effect within our culture. There's so many things that actually lend itself within Australia to being a successful football nation. And the big question is, I think the step backwards is we need to actually define our development pathways and our style of play around who we are as Australians. And I think that's a good starting point. If we can try and align the way we live as Australians with the way we want to play football and the way we want to develop footballers, I think that's a great way to take this forward. Certainly it's better than trying to adopt what's worked in other countries, because things work in certain markets or certain countries for specific reasons, and some are social and cultural, not just footballing. And so we need to find a social and cultural, or a universal cultural approach to the development of footballers in this country that suits who we are as a community.
Well, just picking up on that point, something I've been thinking a lot about on the back of this study is just the unique challenges that elite Australian footballers face in their career, not just even compared to other sports people, but compared to any profession. So teachers, administrators like yourself, researchers like myself. Not many people in Australia actually have to go overseas to sort of reach world-class status in their fields, whereas for Australian footballers, that's pretty much an essential step that they need to need to take. And that to make a success of that, it requires a lot more than just technical football quality. You need resilience. You need the determination. Can we do more to sort of support the Australians who do go overseas and sort of help recreate the sense of brotherhood and the sense of a collective football mission? Because one of the things I think we saw from the study is that probably as the A-League has improved over the years and become more of a viable alternative for our players overseas, perhaps that's been one factor, certainly not a leading one, but in more players sort of choosing to come back to the A-League as that sort of safety net rather than maybe sticking it out in Europe or overseas for an extra couple of years. And when they do that, they take up another spot in the A-League that sort of might prevent another younger player coming through here. So is that something that we could maybe do more or sort of work with the players in partnership to try and invest this mentality to support each other to make more of a go of it abroad?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a finite pool of players, and I think that's the point. We don't have the luxury of just relying on numbers game. We have to actually almost individually case manage all of our talented players to make sure they're achieving as much as possible out of their career. In terms of that bounce back concept of players leaving Europe early, I mean, that's another thing we'd have to look at closely. Again, anecdotally, that might be true. I don't know if it is, but we need to do some work and we need to ensure that we're constantly reviewing that type of thing to see if that is the case. And then we need to find solutions to that problem, because we want guys playing at the absolute top of world football, because that means our national team's stronger, it means we have more profile for the sport, and it acts as an inspiration for the young kids who are taking the game on. I mean, most players in their 30s and 40s will have been inspired by Craig Johnson playing the FA Cup in the 80s, and that's and in the European Champions League or the European Cup then, and that's what inspires people to take the sport up and want to emulate those people, same way Harry Kewell did for a younger generation. So we need to have players who, like Aaron Moy, are now at the absolute top of the world pyramid and inspiring the new generation of players. And, you know, and that feeds into the arguments around expansion and a second tier is, yeah, maybe players aren't good enough to make it in Europe, or for whatever reason the barriers are too big for them to get over. They should be able to come back to the A-League and build a career here, because there's you know, it's got potential to be a great competition. They're continuing to improve their football, and then they can bounce back into the high leagues or the higher leagues throughout Europe or Asia down the track. But for them to do that, you made the point that they might be taking the spot of a younger player or an emerging footballer. That may be the case, but the reality is when you've got 9 teams based in Australia, 1 in New Zealand, people are going to miss out. And I think we pointed in our study to the huge decline in match minutes for players under the age of 20, where it's probably gone halved in the last 5 or 6 years, or even a greater decline than that. And that's not ideal, because we need to be having emerging players for the junior national teams, for the senior national teams. We know how important match minutes between the ages of 18 and 21 are. So we need to have those young guys in the system. But we also need to have a high-quality competition. So, you know, the ideal way to do that is really to start building more teams and high-quality environments for players to make a living as a professional footballer. So that's why arguments around a second tier, around expanding the A-League, or building our professional footprint more generally are really important. They walk hand in glove with having a competitive national team and competitive national teams more generally.
Yeah, well, the study found that the more minutes that players accumulate in the A-League before they go overseas were correlated with how likely they were to establish themselves overseas. So how much experience you had in the A-League was actually a more important indicator than at what age you went overseas as to whether you were going to stick it out and succeed over there. And it also found that hitting certain benchmarks in terms of league minutes before certain ages, by the age of 21 or 24, had a high correlation, around 70% plus, with becoming a Socceroo. So you're absolutely right in saying that for those young players, that getting opportunities in the A-League, the league has a massive role to play in developing those players.
Yeah, and there's no shame in a team adopting a youth focus. I mean, some of the best teams in the world, most famous teams in the world, unashamedly see themselves as being an incubator for some of the world's best footballing talent, whether it's Monaco, whether it's Ajax, you know, teams that reached the very top of European football last season, and they've done so with young players. But that's a very systematic, institutionalised way of thinking. So that's the end product of a whole-of-club plan and a whole, you know, youth development structure from 7 to 20. To think an A-League club working in isolation with one or two teams within their structure can replicate that is highly challenging. So, you know, this goes back to that whole notion of doing this broader research project about saying what are the factors that are assisting or impeding our development of players, things like short-term contracting, things like not having cohesive pathways for players within the same club from the age of 12. There's so many variables that may impact on whether or not a player achieves their potential as a footballer, notwithstanding the personal challenges that a player has to go through. You know, you spoke about players coming back and the whole concept of building resilience for players that, you know, if they're in Europe or in Asia and times get tough, and they will get tough, every player you speak to will have one, two, three, four horror stories they had to endure to retain a career in Europe. And they need to build resilience and a thick skin to get through those. And it's a lot easier to do that when you know you don't have anything to come home to, no doubt. So it's, you know, it's such a big project that we need to undertake to start shaping policy that will be effective not just for the short term but generationally, so we have a blueprint for what it means to be an Australian footballer and how to develop an Australian footballer.
Yeah, sure. And we've touched on a couple of individual players. Aaron Moy is one who did come back from Europe at a young age and made a fantastic success of himself in the A-League, and Mark Milligan's another top performer for the national team at the moment who's never played in Europe. So there's definitely more than one way to skin a cat. I think for every sort of rule or benchmark the report threw up, you can easily throw back some exceptions to that. Mille Edenac's a late bloomer, for instance, who bucked a lot of those trends in terms of youth minutes. So what would you sort of say for young players or parents of young players sort of looking at this study and maybe being a bit alarmed about sort of the pathway laid out in front of them and the challenges that are there in terms of the decisions that they now need to make?
Yeah, well, I think with a PFA hat on, I think it's really important that young players particularly have a very balanced life. I think a lot of the studies we've done of overseas clubs who have got elite academies like Boca Juniors and Barcelona and throughout Germany, they all have a really high focus on developing the person, not just the footballer. So they're really focused on ensuring the player has a strong family network or strong relationships to help them through any adversity they might have. A real emphasis on school and learning and the capacity to learn. So it's not just about knowing your maths or your English, but having the discipline to learn things, which is so important as a footballer, the ability to pick up patterns of play and coach instructions. It's all critical now to be a high-performing footballer. But, you know, you have those intangibles around hard work and sacrifice and a little bit of luck, and they're timeless. No player has been able to have a sustainable career at the top level without being prepared to sacrifice, without doing the hard work, and all the great Australian players. So if you look at towards the back of the report, we list the 100 or the top 50 Australian players in terms of the weighted model that the PFA's put together, and all those players will have countless stories of where they've sacrificed for their career in the name of their career, in the name of becoming a successful footballer. So there's all of those personality traits that players need to develop, and I think part of this research project is probably to see, has that changed? So generationally, have we switched, or particularly in Australia, have we switched from players who are prepared to sacrifice everything to players who might want things a little bit easier? And I don't know, I'm not saying that's the truth, but that's something we need to look at. And, you know, we might say we have a cushy life here in Australia and we play, you know, PlayStation, but so they do that in France as well. They do that in the Netherlands. And again, France have got an unbelievable team at the moment, all full of young footballers who are products of, you know, generation me. And Ajax continues to have more players in the top five leagues of the world than any other club. So, you know, these Western democracies that Australia is a part of still can produce these unbelievably talented players.
Yep. Well, I think the report has provided a lot of answers, but it's probably raised twice as many questions. So looking forward to launching into the next link in the chain and the next part of the sort of socio-cultural study to start to identify where we're falling short and where we can improve.
Yeah, was there any final stats you think, Brett, that were really worth noting that caught your eye through the documentation? I mean, the big thing for me that I noticed was the big decline in minutes for players under the age of 20 and the overall decline, or the significant decline in the players in the top five leagues. So for me, that's quite alarming. And the sooner we can start a really holistic industry, holistic solution to those challenges is important across the entire industry. It can't be people working in isolation, because everybody has to contribute to these solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think a lot of people think back to the end of the NSL and the sort of 18-month black hole before the A-League started up again, and the impact that that might have had on sort of elite youth development, and the fact that we're now kind of going through this transition where the Centre of Excellence in Canberra has closed and we're now expecting the A-League clubs through their academies to pick up that slack, but a lot of them are still sort of getting their academies into sort of full working order. So we need to be working with them and sort of thinking through this collectively as a football community and football industry to make sure that we sort of don't let anything fall through the cracks again.
Yeah, agree. So thanks again, Brett. It's a great report. It's available on the PFA website and directly from the PFA if you'd like a copy. And I think it's a great starting point for ongoing discussion on youth development and how we can make our national teams and our leagues as strong as possible. Thanks again, mate.
Thank you, John.